The lights are on red. We're away.
Hi, you're listening to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. My name is Jules Cisek. I'm sitting in for Bob Hayes one more time. Today is Friday, May 2nd, and this is show 125. Today's show is going to be a little bit different format than the previous shows we've had. We're going to talk a little less about motorcycle racing, although I will go through some news items that have come up this week. But the primary focus of the show is motorsports photography. And we have two guests on the show this time around. We have Scott Jones from Turn 2 Photography and Andrew Wheeler from Automoto Photo, who is the official AMA photographer for a couple of magazines here in the U.S. and in Europe, who also is a World Superbike and MotoGP photographer. We had a great conversation with both these guys. I think you'll really enjoy them. Okay, I'm going to start off with World Superbike Round, which took place last weekend at the SNTT circuit in the Netherlands. The Cathedral did not disappoint. As we discussed last week, it was in 2007 we had some great races, and this year we also had two very good superbike races, an absolutely incredible supersport race. If you don't normally watch supersport, make time to watch this one. I don't think I've ever seen such a close fight between so many riders, except possibly in a 125 GP series. I'm not going to go over the results of the acid round, as many of you probably still have them on your TiVo or equivalent, but suffice to say that you will not be disappointed when you watch them. There are a bunch of worthwhile tidbits of news in MotoGP this week, my favorite being an article that David Emmett posted on MotoGP Matters. David writes about the dramatic change of balance at the Yamaha factory team now that they have two serious championship contenders. Not to take anything away from Colin Edwards and his predecessor Carlos Checa, but this is the first time since 2002 that someone other than Valentino Rossi has won a race on a Yamaha, that last person being Max Biaggi. So Yamaha find themselves in a very interesting position where there is no top rider and support rider. And on top of that, they have a truly championship-worthy machine this year. So I think this gives them serious bargaining power with Valentino Rossi. And the article goes on to suggest that for the first time in his life, Rossi may be facing a pay cut. I don't have time to go through the entire article. I think it's really worthwhile reading. So follow the link from the show notes and check out the rest of it. There's also a little tidbit about movie star Telefonica coming back to sponsor Yamaha. Another entry on David's blog is regarding a rumor that Marco Melandri, who is still totally failing to get to grips with Denisma Sedici, may end up replacing Ant West at Kawasaki, the latter rider obviously on the cutting block, and possibly before the end of the season. David got this info from an Italian website, and we know that thankfully not all rumors turn out to be true. For example, there is a race in China this weekend. But who knows, maybe it's not that far-fetched. I'm recording this show just as FP2 is wrapping up in China, and the big news is that Jorge Lorenzo had a very nasty high side during free practice one, and is now confirmed that he has a chipped bone on the outside of his left ankle. Ouch. That is not good. That is the foot that the rider uses to shift the bike, the gears on the bike. Ah, that's really bad. In free practice one, Valentino Rossi led that practice and was the only one to dip under the 2 minute mark. He was almost a half a second faster than second fastest Casey Stoner, and perhaps more importantly, almost a second faster than third fastest Danny Pedrosa, who shares the lead in the championship with Jorge Lorenzo. Meanwhile, fourth fastest rider was Dovizioso, so he's continuing his impressive rookie season. And he's followed by John Hopkins in fifth. And John Hopkins is going to be racing his 100th MotoGP race on Sunday. Wow, he's been in this sport for a long time, and he's still a young guy. At the bottom of the timesheets, Marco Melandri, almost 5 seconds slower than Valentino Rossi. And to make things worse, over a second and a half slower than the next slowest guy, Danting Ducati rider Sylvain Guintoli. And Jorge Lorenzo did not even ride in free practice two, it looks like. He's not on the sheet. I haven't actually read any report yet. I'm just looking at the timesheet. He's not classified. So the injury is definitely going to be a problem this weekend. I'm sure that Dr. Costa and Clinica Mobile are working hard to get Jorge back on the track, but this really is going to put a damper in his plans for sure. The fastest man in free practice two was Casey Stoner, but just 5/100ths behind him was Valentino Rossi, and then a further about 1.5 tenths behind him, Danny Pedrosa. I think we're going to have a great race between these three guys. Interestingly, fourth fastest in FP2 is Shinya Nakano on the Gresini Honda. Fifth, once again, is Hopkins, so I think he's in good shape for this race. Melandri dramatically improved since FP1 and is now just 1.7 seconds of Stoner's pace, but still just 14th fastest. James Tosin is struggling also. He finished 17th. Ooh, ouch. 17th in free practice one and 13th in free practice two, over a second and a half slower than the leaders. That's the first time James has been on this track. Hopefully he'll improve tomorrow before qualifying. As we expected, Bridgestone is doing well in China, with free practice two showing 7 of the top 10 positions filled by Bridgestone equipped bikes. This, of course, bodes well for Valentino Rossi and Casey Stoner. And we may see a repeat of last year's battle between those two, which was pretty much edge of the seat the entire way. So that would be great. Okay, another MotoGP news this week. Colin Edwards has announced his intention to stay in MotoGP. I'm not sure if there's a contract on the table right now, but he has pretty much ruled out returning to the U.S. and racing in the AMA. And frankly, who can blame him with all the political BS going on in that series? I think Colin finally gets to taste what it's like to be unencumbered and on a very competitive team. Remember, aside from his stint in Aprilia, he was pretty much a sidekick rider for the last 4 years, first to Sete Gibernau and then to Valentino Rossi. Best of luck to Colin this weekend, this year, and I would definitely be very happy to see him continue in the series for a few more seasons. Toby Moody writes on Autosport.com about John Surtees, famous for being the only racer to win a top-class world championship on both four wheels in Formula One and two wheels in Grand Prix motorcycle racing. Surtees is unveiling a new 125cc GP team in China, and they are, I think, getting set for a full season in 2009. I'm not sure if they're going to be making an appearance this year. I guess we'll wait to see. Let's see what else we got. Michael Schumacher is not racing in MotoGP. I just thought that I'd mention that because the rumor is just not dying. But when asked about the most recent version, having him ride a wild card entry with Ducati, he says, "No, certainly not." Okay, good. Finally, a hilarious story on Crash.net about a Valentino Rossi lookalike who says he's sorry for taking advantage of his resemblance to one of the most famous sports celebrities in the world. He apparently was signing autographs and took a female fan for a ride on his Yamaha motorcycle. He says he's sorry. I think it's pretty hilarious. Okay, so that's just a very quick wrap-up of news this week. And now let's go to the interview with Andrew Wheeler. Hi, we have Andrew Wheeler on the phone with us today, actually on Skype. Andrew Wheeler is a motorsports photographer, primarily a motorcycle photographer now, right?
That's correct.
Who is a senior AMA photographer for Road Racer X. And you're also, I know you're involved with a lot of magazines because you're a freelancer.
Right.
There's some UK magazine, Motorcycle Racer, and you're the official AMA guy there.
Right.
So does that mean that you go to all the races and in the US for the AMA rounds?
Yep, I cover all the AMA Superbike series in the USA for Road Racer X and Motorcycle Racer. I also have work published on a consistent basis with Performance Bikes, Bike Magazine, and occasionally Motorcycle News out of the UK. And also with Cycle World here, and I maintain a small column with Cycle World here in the US as well on their website.
Right. I've seen those photos of yours from time to time. So what I want to just be able to talk to you about is, you know, your life as a motorsports photographer, how you got into it, and then some more specific stuff about, you know, how do you photograph fast-moving objects?
Well, how I got into it was really, I first, obviously, as some of you might know or may not, for what it's worth, I actually started out photographing horses. And photography has never really been a hobby for me. So I started out photographing horses initially because I had... Our horse had a very serious illness and with their feet, and so we needed to have a vet at another location look at the damage to her feet, and so that's how I got into photography. I bought a Canon G2 point-and-shoot camera, and so I started with that, and then... Once we had, you know, after 2 years and a boatload of money, got Ginger back to health, I started doing the odd portraiture session with this little camera, which led, with the funds from that, which led me to buy a Canon D60 and various other lenses. And then I got work through Arabian Horse World, and I did some stuff for... Cavalier, which is a horse show, sort of Cirque du Soleil show style show. Then, typically, the equine work sort of drops off around, you know, the late autumn, early winter, and in essence, the money dries up at the same time. So, my wife and I had a little chat about. That I wasn't making any money, and it was either get a real job or find new avenues to bring more revenue in. So she suggested that I go and photograph testing at Laguna Seca, which was happening, which happens early winter or early January, February.
You live nearby there, right?
Yes, I live about 30 miles north of Laguna Seca. So... With that in mind, went down to Laguna Seca and didn't know anyone, just pretty much took down what gear I had, a Canon D60 and a 70-200 lens, and quite simply just thought, let's take some photographs. And, you know, without much thought to anything except what appeals to me, took these photographs. I've always been a motorcyclist. I've always loved motorcycling. And so there was a natural interest in the sport. And with testing, it's always nice because you can get up close to people and there's less pressure on anyone. Subsequently, came home, went through the images, and my wife suggested that I should, you know, they looked a little bit different and a little bit more pop than what was out there at the time. And so she suggested that I send them to Cycle World. So I contacted Matthew Miles at Cycle World, who is the one of the editors down there, and he liked what I sent and suggested that I might want to try go to Infineon. So they arranged for me to go up to Infineon, and I shot some more testing photographs. And in essence, it just kind of grew from there. And so I started the first race that I went to was I missed Daytona, and then I went to Cal Speedway Fontana for the AMA races. I think that was 3 years ago. And in essence, it's sort of taken off from there. And
so you mentioned you got a D60 as a Canon D60, which is, I think, 2003?
Uh-huh. And
it's funny because you started with a G2, which is also a digital camera.
Right.
So one of the questions I had for you was, how do you find, do you miss film? Obviously you don't, because you never really shot with film.
I never shot anything commercially with film. Aside from back home, when I, long before I met my wife, I got into sort of what I would call gloom and doomy, black and white, self-processed architectural photography. But
don't we all?
Yeah, the dark black and white, heavy grain, sort of stylish sort of photography, and developed my own stuff, and that was fine. But never really picked it up again until our horse got sick. And so with the money I made from doing work for the G2, I bought the D60, and likewise, it's just gone from there.
Very cool. So when you say you go to Daytona, you go to at least, especially all the AMA races, do you actually, like on the business side, do you actually fly yourself out there, or is somebody providing you with, you know, tickets to go out there and shoot for them?
It all depends. It's pretty much self-funded. I think some would say this is done on spec initially, but now a lot of my work is, I'm retained by various magazines. So in essence, I'm still a freelancer, but there's an income now. So my work goes to obviously these magazines. It goes to various advertisers from time to time. And, you know, pretty much everything is a profit now. So, I started out, you know, you'll find that most sports photographers in this world do fund themselves to do this. Whether they make any money at it is another matter, and you'll never know because it's, you know, it's not the sort of thing people are going to talk about, but that's how it works. Not necessarily a good business decision, but again, if you have a business plan and you're smart, you produce something that's different, and you're good at self-promotion and marketing, you can make it work.
So when you're shooting an AMA race, are you working with other photographers that are going to, like, pool all their images together at the end?
No, you are pretty much not in an agency sense. I mean, I work independently. You know, you see the same people from race to race, but that's about as far as it goes. Pretty much you work for yourself, and you know, there are other photographers that work in a group of two or three maybe, and then they pull their images. But for me, I'm like myself and others, we tend to work independently.
And then some editor at the magazine just chooses photos from your batch, from like Andrew Northcott's thing.
How it works with Road Racer X, we pretty much edit our own work. And so for Andrew or Andrew myself, we'll select what we think is relevant from the weekend and upload them to their server, and then they make the selections based on whatever they need for the magazine or the website or whatever.
And okay, so you're basically, you go out there by yourself. You must, you know, just move around the track. You're not just sitting in one place.
Oh no.
And you got lots of sessions during which to shoot. But like when you're shooting a race, you know, how do you make sure that you get some variety in your images, so you don't just get, because you want to sell more than one image, obviously. So you want to go to different corners during the race, but you also want to catch all the action. Like it's easy to shoot over a weekend because you've got a lot of testing sessions and qualifying. But when you're shooting just one session, that's the part where I'm always amazed at, like, the variety that a single photographer can come up with.
Well, it helps if you have a scooter. I have access to a scooter, so a lot of this stuff is just you work out the best way to maximize your image base, or in other words, what you need for a particular race. And so you think to yourself, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go here. I'm not a big fan of always hanging around corners, just because I think you end up with, for example, if you take a superbike race after the current, you know, especially the current racing right now, after about the first two or three laps, the bikes have in essence broken up into their small little battles, if there are little battles, and it looks like a qualifying session. So most of your, if you want pack shots or at least two or three bikes in a frame, you're gonna want to be in a good spot for the first three to five laps, and then it starts breaking up, and you can wander, and in essence, you start working your way back towards the podium, which, you know, obviously people want to have podium shots at the end. I find podium shots, you know, they can be a little bit repetitive, but that's just the way that it goes. So, but that's just it. I mean, on a race day, you know, for example, at Fontana last weekend, you have, you know, on the Sunday, you have three races in a row with about 15 to 20 minutes from the end of one race to the beginning of another. So you have to have some idea of how you're going to plan your afternoon out, and whether you're going to duplicate an image, or you're going to get, say, you know, for a superbike weekend, you'll have a race on a Saturday and a race on a Sunday. So maybe on the Saturday you do the track stuff where you're guaranteed that you'll have most of the people in the race, and then on Sunday you could go and maybe do grid. You can do how close you can get to a track, get a track shot, and then you're back for the podium.
Got it. And obviously, track knowledge really helps here, because you've been to some of these tracks multiple times, so you know, like, which places will yield a really nice image. Like, I've only been going to Laguna and Infineon to actually take photos with a long lens. So, like, I've got a couple of corners that I know work really well. And actually, the thing I wanted to ask you about the corners thing, it's like, corners are actually very easy to shoot because the bikes are slower. How do you shoot guys coming down a straight? Because I've seen some amazing shots, like from Mugello, for example, down that long straight, where you see, like, Loris Capirossi in a Ducati, and he's all in focus, perfectly in focus, and then you see this beautiful train of bikes behind him. I mean, these guys are going over 200 miles an hour.
Yeah, but if you look at what they're coming at you, they're really not that. It's even though they're coming at you at that speed, they're actually, if you look head on, they're kind of static almost, because they're coming straight at you. So you have a certain amount of time to set up how you want to shoot a head-on shot, because they are coming at you. There's no wavering on the line. They're not really changing any line direction. Whereas, and in a focal plane, it's almost 2D. It's almost like dead flat. So, you know, you set up how you want to where you want to focus, and then, you know, in essence, the bike or whatever it is comes into the shot.
Oh, so you're actually pre-focusing on those kinds of shots?
Sometimes. It all depends. It all depends on the where you are, because you invariably, you never shoot from the same place each time. I mean, if that means I get less, then that's just the way it happens. But, you know, for your own sanity, sometimes you have to not do the same thing year in, year out, because you're just going to, your images are just going to show that this is just the same thing year in, year out.
Right. I mean, some places you can't avoid, you know, the corkscrew. There's only so many places there's only so many windows you can go to. But people have gotten very creative. I noticed, there's a big trend in wide angle lately. Do you shoot with a wide angle ever?
Always. I've always shot with wide angles, simply because I always feel that, you know, just take any current magazine aside from in the US, and you'll always look at images that are just close, tight shots, and it just could be anywhere.
That's right.
To me, half the fun of this sport is putting it to a place on a map, or a place that you say, oh, that's so-and-so, or that's so-and-so. I mean, I've always tended to think of the sky as being an important part of an image. And so, yeah, I've heard comments about tiny bike shots, but, you know, it's nice just to be able to see where something is in relative to the rest of its place on this planet. So
right.
Instead of just another knee down shot.
Right. And there's definitely some tracks which are beautiful even without a motorcycle on them, just by itself, just the track itself. So, you know,
Barbara's one of those tracks.
Which one?
Barbara.
Yeah.
I've
seen some incredible photos of VIR.
Yeah, VIR. I think Phillip Island is another nice
track. Yeah, definitely. Track,
good vistas.
You've been there?
Yeah, Phillip Island is one of my favorite racetracks on this planet. I just absolutely. Yeah. It's just cool people, cool track, great, beautifully organized. And you always, there's always a good sky, there's always a good color, it's just beautiful light down there.
My favorite images, like literally from the entire calendar, usually come from Phillip Island. Like, you see the ocean, you know, in the background, and it's just
right.
Like, that pretty much summarizes like what you're talking about, the location. You instantly realize, oh wow, look at that, that is the ocean. That's not like, you know, grass runoff and then nothing and a well covered with advertisements, you know.
Well, there's a particular shot I have of I have one from this year of, well, I have many shots, but there was one I took this year of Pedrosa, of Danny Pedrosa, Honda factory rider, and also last year I took a photograph of Nicky Hayden, actually on the Gardner, I think it's Gardner Strait.
Yes, exactly.
The front straight at Phillip Island, and it has the impression that they're going to take off. It's like looking at the deck of an aircraft carrier. When you look from the back towards the start-finish line, underneath with a sign there, it says Melbourne, and you picture it between the gantry that holds the start lights and the track, you can see the sea in the background, and it just looks like an aircraft carrier that they're going to take off from. So,
nice.
You know, it's a picturesque track. There's a lot to do. There's a lot of opportunities to try something different there because there's no fencing. And even as a spectator, you know, a spectator can come away with something half decent as well, because the spectator fencing is only waist high because the track is separated by a natural sort of moat. Between the track, there's a dry moat, and then there's the fencing where everybody sits down. So, you know, you don't necessarily need to have credentials to try and, you know, to think that you can't get a decent image. I mean, I've photographed cars without credentials for long before I really got anywhere with bikes, and you know, people thought I had credentials, but I didn't. You just have to work a little bit harder and think a bit more.
So, but you mainly try. So you do some MotoGP and World Superbike, right?
No, I don't do any. I my first World Superbike will be this year at Miller, but I would like to do more. Sorry about that.
That's it.
I would like to do more World Superbike. But, you know, currently right now, it's my commitments are the AMA Superbike Series. And then when time allows that they don't clash, then I go off and do some MotoGP as well. So I will be doing both MotoGPs this year in the US, possibly the British Grand Prix, and then the Australian Grand Prix, and then the last round at Valencia at the end of the year.
Oh, wow, Valencia.
Yes.
That's another place where you can get some incredible shots if you do wide angle and show that gigantic crowd in the stadium.
Oh, the wall of people in Valencia is quite overwhelming. It's a good track. It's another, you know, it's colorful. There's a lot of color. The people really add a certain spice to the image there.
Yeah. Just one more question that I had technical wise.
Yeah.
Software. Do you use like Photoshop still, or you moved to Lightroom or Aperture, one of those guys?
I have Photoshop CS3, and I have Lightroom, but I also have Aperture as well. I mean, I use Aperture less, but I use Lightroom, and I use Photoshop CS3. So I bought Aperture before I purchased Lightroom, and then I used Lightroom, and I found Lightroom a little bit easier to use than Aperture, so I use Lightroom more than I do Aperture. But yeah, simply I use CS3. I shoot in RAW only. I never shoot JPEG. Right. In fact, I've never shot a JPEG out of any of my cameras. So
even back in the G2 days when you were using
I always shot RAW, even out of the Canon G2, and that was before there was any decent RAW converters, and they were all linear RAW converters, and so I've shot RAW. It just, you know, it's the processing of images has got easier as technology has caught up with it. I mean, when you first started shooting RAW, it was kind of painful, but the benefits to shooting RAW, I mean, you still get it right first time, but you have a larger file that eventually you can go back and if you need to make something, there's nothing lost in the image, whereas obviously with JPEG you lose stuff because of compression. So
right, and that's actually why I don't even touch Photoshop anymore, because Lightroom and Aperture, they both allow you to make changes to the images based on the raw file, but they don't actually modify it, so you can, you know, undo to your heart's content, you know, even years later.
I still tend to lean, even though sometimes, I mean, I've got 4 gigs of RAM in a Monster MacBook Pro, so everything runs quite nicely. I will still tweak or what I would call develop an image in Adobe, you know, in Camera Raw versus Lightroom, and then, you know, it depends. It just I have these moods that sometimes I want to just do it this way, and so, you know, between CS3 and Lightroom, then that's what I do.
Cool. But anyway, so that's so this year you're doing all of AMA. Are you obviously going to do the two MotoGP races, and you said Miller,
right?
Do you do anything besides those series?
Nope. I only shoot motorcycle racing. I used to do. I mean, I do some car stuff at Mid Ohio. excuse me, sports car course, but really that's. That's about the extent. I used to shoot cars for do some work with that A-Team, do Champ Car Series, but really my work is entirely just motorcycle racing, and that's all I do. I mean, I don't even pick up the cameras as a hobby. I have a little Canon G9 that I take pictures of our dog with and our cats, and I actually use a G9 sometimes for work because it's a handy little camera to have around, but. That's pretty much it. In fact, I'm pretty busy enough with motorcycle photography that I don't really need anything else. So,
that's great.
I'm not bored.
And you said you ride.
I ride too. Yes, I keep a. I have my own little blog off my website, but I also write for a small column for Cycle World on their website after I come back from races and. You know, just from my perspective, not the usual sort of timing and scoring type details, but just things that I've observed over a race weekend, something, you know, the flavor of the race weekend. You know, for example, like I noticed Barber was sort of a little bit flat because of the announcement from the DNG group the other week. So,
right.
You know, not wanting to get into, you know, all of that. But, you know, I observe things outside of the racing versus, you know, just telling that so-and-so beat so-and-so by X amount of time. So,
which you can get from anywhere else.
Right. And race weekends are, to me, a more of a pageant than anything else. There's all the color, there's people, there's something medieval in a race weekend for me. So that's how I see it.
Oh, I like that, like a joust?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, that's how I've always seen race weekends, with the colors, the bikes, you know, the
coat of arms, everybody's got their
colors. You know, they're different helmets and it's just a great weekend of with good people.
Do you get tired of it?
No.
No? Cool.
No. The worst part for me is actually leaving. I hate leaving my home. I hate leaving my pets and leaving my wife. So it's a double-edged sword. You know, I'm all right once I get on the plane and I'm going. It's like, okay, we're going. But the drive to the airport every time is misery for me sometimes. So I love what I do, and I wouldn't change it for the world. And I'm grateful to my wife for believing in me with doing this. But each time, all I can, you know, I look forward to meeting the people that I work with over the weekend, and fellow photographers and the racers and the teams, the crew and everybody. But when Sunday night, when I pack my stuff away, I just can't wait to get back on a plane and come home and be back home again.
Nice. Okay, Andrew, this has been really great chatting with you.
Okay.
Anything else you wanted to say?
Well, you can just check out my site at www.automotophoto.com, and, you know, do feel free to check out my blog, which can be reached off on my website. The URL is far too long, so
I'll post it to the
okay
the show notes.
Yeah, but then yeah, anybody feel free to check that out, and, you know, feel free to write. I might not get back to you straight away, but, you know, people do write to me, and that's about it.
Great, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
All right, ciao.
Great stuff from Andrew. Thank you very, very much for being on the show.
Okay, now we have Scott Jones with us.
Hi, Joel.
Skype, how's it going?
Going great.
Scott is a motorsports photographer. Would you call yourself an amateur?
Yeah.
He and I have shared some adventures at Laguna Seca last year, and we've shot together at Sears Point as well, Infineon Raceway. And Scott and I are going to talk about the more technical aspects of motorsports photography. Fast-moving
right.
objects. And
yeah, fast-moving objects on a track, right?
Yeah. So, first thing I wanted to talk about was just give us a very quick overview of who you are. Oh, you're the same guy who's provided articles for MotoGP only before. Scott wrote an article about Big Bang and Screamer Motors, and you also wrote an article about pneumatic valves that I thought was really cool.
Oh, thanks.
Very in-depth.
Yeah, just a couple ideas that Bob had that I think he wanted just to farm out a little research, and it was a lot of fun to do those. I learned a lot, and hope people who listen to those podcasts learned a little bit too.
Yep, I did. Okay, so that's the intro, and now let's chat about photography.
Cool.
Okay. All right. Well, let's talk about the basics of. We're not going to get too deep into the terminology. One of the things that Scott will do is he has a blog on his website that he will link to in the show, and he'll post a couple of links there to articles he's written in the past where he talks about a lot of these technical things we're going to be discussing. But let's just go over the very, very quickly, like, you know, what is aperture, what is shutter speed, what is focal length, so that when we discuss these things like f-stops and whatever later on, we'll understand what we're talking about.
Okay. Let's see, where to start? That's a lot of information.
Well, let's just do it quickly. Like, very basically speaking, like, we've got we're trying to capture the right amount of light onto a sensor, whether it's, it used to be film, now it's a little digital chip that digitizes the light it receives. So there's two ways to control how much light comes into onto that chip. One is by how long the shutter is open, and the other is by how large of an opening you have in your lens.
Right, and the third of the two is how fast you have the ISO set to.
Well, that doesn't change the amount of light that actually hits it. That just changes the sensitivity of the chip.
Well, right, yeah, okay. So that's but still part of the
it's equation very important.
Getting
yes.
a proper exposure.
Yes, right. Yes, very true.
So at your aperture is how big the opening in the lens is. And that is also an important one because that has a big influence on how on the depth of field, the depth of focus, how much of the how far from the camera is going to be in focus and how far is going to be out of focus. So the larger the opening, the smaller the number, generally the shallower the depth of field. So when you're trying to get your subject to be clearly in focus and the background out of focus, you want to try to use as large an aperture or as small a number. It's a weird kind of inverse relationship between those two things as you can, as a general rule. And conversely, if you want to, when you're shooting things that are moving really fast, like motorcycles or racing cars, you want to have, and you want a nice sharp image, you want to have as fast a shutter speed as you can manage, unless you're intentionally trying to blur some part of the image, as in when you're panning, trying to blur the background and have just the car or the bike in focus and really give a sense of motion. So there's sorts of two extremes of that. For one, you want a really fast shutter speed to stop the action, get everything really nicely in focus, nice and sharp, and then when you're panning, you want to go to a much slower shutter speed so that you can track the camera with the same motion that the moving object is passing in front of you and intentionally blur the background.
And, you know, the balance of those two things is actually one of the hardest things for people to figure out. A lot of photographers will stay in the P mode or program mode, which figures all that kind of stuff out for you based on the situation, usually meaning like a decent shutter speed and a decent depth of field so that because the camera has no idea what you're shooting.
Right. That's a good point. As sophisticated as digital SLRs are now, the little computer that they have on board is nowhere near as sophisticated as your brain is. So to get the best results out of the camera that you can, you're just going to have to accept that you're going to have to switch away from the fully automatic mode and at least go to shutter priority or aperture priority mode. And ideally, once you develop the experience to do so, go to full manual so that you have control over all the settings and you're getting the camera to do exactly what you want it to do for the specific situation that you're in and the type of photograph that you're trying to take.
So I'll just quickly explain those two modes. So in aperture priority mode means that you get to set the aperture to what you want. So you're controlling how much light is coming into the lens by the size of the opening, and that gives you control over the depth of focus that you got. And then the computer adjusts the shutter speed so that you have the right exposure, and that can lead to mistakes if you underestimate just how slow the shutter speed is going to get, and then you end up with a very blurry photo. A lot of photos that look like they're out of focus are actually not out of focus. They're due to camera shake, especially when you're shooting with a big lens. You've got a lot of weight in your hands, and you and your hand is not going to be completely steady. You may even have, even on a monopod or a tripod, you might still be moving the thing around a little bit. And if your shutter speed's slow enough, the slight tap on the lens or whatever will end up blurring the image that very often comes up looking like it's out of focus. People say, "Oh, my focus autofocus is not working," but it's actually blur. I think camera shake is one of the most common mistakes that people don't realize is what the cause of it is.
Yeah, and especially the if you go down to the rental store and rent a long lens, the longer your focal length, the more at risk you are for that kind of thing.
Right.
Which is why you often see, when you see the pros shooting with a long lens on a monopod, they'll put their non-trigger hand at the end of the lens to hold the whole thing steady, just to brace the entire apparatus that they're using as they're pointing it at the subject, to just try to keep the whole set of equipment there as steady as they can.
And then the shutter speed priority is the opposite of that. Basically, you set it to a speed that you want. Let's say that you're seeing, you actually want a little bit of blur, so you want to set the shutter speed to like 1/200th of a second which is actually, it sounds fast, but it's actually not that fast when you're considering how fast these vehicles move around the track, especially when you're panning, as they're going horizontally, not towards you. So then the computer adjusts the aperture, but then you might get into a situation where, in order to satisfy the shutter speed, it overexposes the image because it can't close the aperture enough, so you have to, that balance is hard, and that's why I agree with you completely. Like, basically, once you get a hold of these settings, you end up really, the best thing to do is go to manual.
Yeah, and constantly reevaluate what your settings are, because not only will you change from moment to moment the type of picture that you're trying to take, but the conditions around you will constantly be changing, at least subtly, if not dramatically. The clouds come in front of the sun and the lighting changes. You move to a little bit different part of the track, and the way the light is hitting the track is different.
Time of day. Over an hour, as the sun is going down towards later in the day, 1 hour makes a tremendous difference in the angle, and your light is very different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, things like that, and just changing your position on the track a little bit, because if you're at a 90-degree turn, and at one point you're shooting, at one angle to the light source, and then you move and shoot the other part of the turn, you've changed your where the light is hitting your subject.
Exactly.
In a very significant way, and not only is that going to affect the light on their subject, but also all these figures that you're trying to keep in your head about what the camera is doing to get a proper exposure for the type of picture that you're trying to take. So that's a big tip, is to constantly be checking your settings to be as mindful as you can of what your goal is, what type of picture you're trying to take, and to make sure that the settings on your camera suit that type of picture.
Yep, and the cameras do have, usually most of the better SLRs, actually pretty much all of them now have an viewfinder meter scale that shows you approximately where your exposure is falling. Is it underexposed or overexposed? And you can use that to kind of, oops, I've gone too far, mm-hmm. and I need to readjust or something like that.
Yeah, are you talking about just the light meter, or actually
light meter,
histogram?
The light meter. The histogram is the after-the-fact one.
Yeah, but that's a good one to check.
It is.
To get in the habit of checking that. If you don't like to have that come up every time on your standard preview mode, at least check it once in a while and just get in the habit. If all the data is down to the left side of the histogram, your image is going to be too dark. If it's all to the right side, it's going to be too light. So you want to have data across the whole spectrum, left and right.
I like when you're shooting in bright sunlight and you can't see the LCD display very well and you can't see your image, you're obviously not going to be seeing the correct exposure. That histogram is extremely useful because it you don't have to see the image to see that you've overexposed right. or underexposed.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned ISO. So the thing about ISO is in the days of film, we would have different sensitivity on the films and different processing techniques that would allow you to shoot in low light situations or but there was always a cost, and the same thing happens to the digital chip. Basically, they're sending more electricity through the chip to pick up more faint amounts of light, but the downside of that is you get a grain effect, you get distortion and noise into your image, which is why it's advisable to shoot at the lowest ISO, always at the lowest ISO that you get the right exposure settings in, and then only bump it up when you actually have to, stop down something or if it's getting dark or for something like that.
Yeah, and that was one of the first, when I started really giving my best effort to shooting at the track, it took a couple times for me to accept that I was going to have to change the ISO in broad daylight, because I thought, there's so much light here, I should be able to shoot whatever I want at the lowest ISO setting of the camera to have the least amount of noise. And what I found my first couple times out was that I just wasn't getting high enough shutter speed, fast enough shutter speed, without boosting the ISO, even in broad daylight sometimes, which seemed really strange to me. But now when I go to the track, I'm just ready to do that. I do it without even second thought if I have to bump it up to get the shutter speed that I'm after when I'm trying to really freeze the action and not have any blur, as little blur as possible.
What do you max out at usually?
Well, when I'm trying to take an on-track picture where only the, say, the wheels turning is going to show any amount of blur, I try to go for at least a thousandth of a second and faster than that if I can, because that helps minimize the other thing you were talking about, camera shake. If I'm shooting through a long lens and if it's windy, which often it is at the track, the faster the shutter speed you can get away with, the better to minimize that. You still generally want to have a little bit of blur in your picture for the things that should be moving, like the wheels.
Otherwise, it's just going to look like a parked vehicle.
Right, exactly. There's nothing more boring for a motorsports, for a sports photography, or something that looks like it's just parked somewhere. Yeah. There's got to be some kind of drama, some kind of action going on. Even when a bike is leaned way over and the lean angle is interesting to look at, if it's totally frozen in time, it just doesn't have the same visual impact as if there's some motion in the thing. But you don't want the decals on the bike and the rider's helmet to be blurry, because then it looks like you didn't do a good job focusing your image. So
right. Yeah, it's always a balance. But I saw a really funny video once of it looked like a guy leaning over in the corner, and then it was a still shot, but then he gets off the bike, and he just basically had a little stand on the side of it. It was pretty hilarious.
Nice.
Okay, one of the interesting things that we had this year, it was the Qatar race was held at night, and a lot of photos arrived. They were pretty spectacular, and I was pretty amazed at how much output we got from those lights on the around the track. But then I was examining the EXIF data, and EXIF data is basically embedded in images by your camera. It's a way that you can then later identify what settings you use, what time the image is taken. Also, some very interesting information.
And lens you use, what camera, all sorts of information gets recorded.
It's very, very, very useful when you have thousands of images. And, man, those guys were shooting at 1600 ISO.
Yeah.
Pretty wild.
Yeah.
So, they were shooting with very high-end cameras that minimize the noise.
Mm-hmm.
But that does explain, you don't just get noise. There's also, like the contrast changes and the white balance is a little bit different than it would be at lower ISO settings. So I think that probably explains why the Ducatis looked a little bit orangish, like this kind of golden red. Mm-hmm. They did paint them a special color, knowing that they're going to be under these lights. And I know that the Dantin team, for example, like put on all sorts of very cool reflective paint and stickers on their bikes to take advantage of the light. But I think there was also a little bit of distortion in colors. That's one thing that also to be aware of, that when you bump up these ISO settings, you're going to compress your color space, you're going to introduce noise, introduce more contrast into the images, and so that's the you know, the downside of it. And of course, like, I shoot with a very old digital SLR, and on my camera I can't really go to even 800 these days. Even like the little Rebels, digital Rebels, will do a great job at 800 ISO. So don't be afraid to go there, you know.
Yeah, and the newer your camera is, the better off you are. The current generation of Canon cameras, which is the brand that I follow more so than Nikon, even though Nikon makes great stuff, and I see fantastic pictures taken with Nikon equipment. I think it's just as good. The noise levels that they're getting at high ISOs is just amazingly low. And that's the main thing that really makes me wish I had the resources to upgrade my camera body.
Right. Yeah.
Sooner rather than later.
Same here. Okay. Last thing I wanted to talk about was focal length. Can you give us a quick intro to focal length?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the longer, the bigger the number, the closer it makes you look like you are through the viewfinder. But again, that introduces problems of camera shake, and that's a big question for people who go to the track without a photo credential, because since you're forced to shoot from the amateur side of the fence, you're really relying on the focal length of your lens to get close to the action. As good as modern digital SLRs are, they're still, the affordable ones for amateurs anyway, are still much lower resolution than film is. I just read an article about the Canon's latest best camera, which is the 1DS Mark III,
mm-hmm.
I think 21 megapixels, and it is almost at the resolution of film, but not quite, even at 21 megapixels.
Which film? So, like Velvia?
Well, I actually don't remember off the top of my head which exact film they were talking to, but film is measured in, its resolution is measured in lines rather than dots per inch or pixels per inch.
Right.
And the 21 megapixel camera was, I was surprised that it was almost as good as, I assume they were talking about 35 millimeter film rather than a medium format film, which means that I shoot with a Canon 30D, which is 8 megapixels, but a lot of pros use the previous generation of 1Ds, and then the new ones are 10 megapixels, which is a lot lower resolution than film was, and the practical effect of that is that you really need to fill the frame with your subject, because you just don't have the resolution to crop to a portion of the image the way you could with film and still get a reasonably sharp image. So the focal length of the lens that you get to use, especially if you're on the amateur side of the fence, is really plays a big role in what your pictures are going to look like. So the working pros who have photo passes and who get to move right next to the track and take advantage of their pro equipment, and they usually have at least 300, 400 millimeter, 500, 600 millimeter lenses, have a big advantage about in that way over people who are going as amateurs and doing a hobby and something that they enjoy doing, who maybe they have at the most a 400. Usually, most of the pictures that are on my website I was taking with a 100 400, the Canon 100 400 zoom lens. And, shooting from the other side of the fence, it was often, usually a challenge to fill the frame even with a 400 millimeter lens. But if you're going to print, I print a lot of my images at 16 by 24 inches, and I can only do that if I have to crop only a tiny amount out of it. Mm-hmm. If I have to crop much more than anything at all, really, I can't print it that size. It just my camera just doesn't have the resolution to do that. So that's got to be one of the biggest challenges. And when you're comparing the pictures that you take to what the pros do with their better equipment and their far superior track access, you definitely have to give yourself a break about that.
A lot of it is like, what are you going to do with your images? You know, I mean, you know, if you're into printing wall size posters, you might have issues. But if you're just doing it for like a website, that's not going to be a big deal. I mean, you're usually downsizing, down-resing the thing tremendously before you put it out on the web.
Oh, yeah. So that's still pretty easy to crop. Even, you know, with the 8-megapixel camera, it's pretty easy to get a usable picture that you're only going to put out at 72 dpi. You can crop quite a bit out of it and still look pretty good then. But if you're trying to make a big print of it, then you really feel the pinch if you have to crop anything at all.
Cool. All right. So that covers all the technical stuff I wanted to talk about. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Technical things? I don't know. Just some odds and ends about practical things of managing the tech side, like make sure that you check all of your equipment before you go to the track. I remember one of the first times I rented an expensive lens, I rented a 300 millimeter f/2.8 lens and brought it to Sears Point to shoot an AMA race, and I got there and filled up my first 2 gigabyte flash card and found that I only had one other 2 gigabyte flash card. I left all my other flash cards at home.
Oh, ouch.
So there's that tunnel at the kind of the north end of the grandstand that leads to that little infield section, and I kept going back there because it was so bright that day. I was editing the pictures that I was taking on my camera's 2.5-inch LCD screen because I just didn't have room. I was trying to do the whole day on 2 gigabyte cards, and when you're shooting, you know, 10 frames in a burst as the bike goes by, you fill up one of those cards really quickly.
Whoa.
That little monitor on my 30D is just not good enough to make a decision about whether that's an image to keep or not. So that was really a noob mistake that I made that one time, and I think the upside is that I will never make that mistake again. Every time I go somewhere, I make damn sure that I have all my compact flash cards.
Well, next time you can just go to the Ducati tent and buy a SanDisk one, $180.
Well, now I travel with I have 12 gigabytes worth of compact flash cards, and the last big event that I shot was the American Le Mans Series at Laguna Seca, and on Saturday when they had the, you know, whatever it was, the 6-hour event, I was really glad that I had paid for the VIP parking and had my truck right there by the lagoon section and had my laptop in the truck, because several times I would go back to the truck and I brought my flashcard reader hooked up to my laptop and I was transferring images from the cards to my laptop. And that weekend I shot over 6,000 images.
Whoa.
You know, didn't keep... I threw most of them away. I mean, a good portion of them away, but it was a nice luxury to be able to just not worry about filling up my cards and having to deal with that kind of thing that I did at Sears Point that day, you know, of having that kind of limited headroom for how much I wanted to shoot. I just fill them up, take the cards back on a break in between sessions, dump them onto my laptop, and I was good to go again. I had my 12 gigabytes to work with. So that's really, really nice thing to be able to bring a laptop to the track, and it's great to be able to have gear in your car that's accessible. You don't have to make a big hike back to some remote parking section to get to it.
That's interesting because, you know, I've kind of had to master a completely different system because I usually ride to Laguna Seca on a motorcycle.
Right, yeah.
And I carry all the gear in a big backpack, but I'm not going to be carrying that backpack around when I'm at the track. So I really try to be really minimal. Like, I have this little card holder that goes in each pocket, and my used cards go from one pocket to the other. And I've got one of those little camera bags that like wraps around just like a belt and just carry it in front. I look like a dork, but at least I got quick reach for my lenses in there. Uh-huh. And you know, and I sling over the big lens is always slung over the shoulder, and you know, I don't shoot rapid fire. I never really did. I never really had a camera that could really do it well, and so I've gotten used to just I shoot with both eyes open, and I actually look down at the barrel of the lens and follow the shot. And you know, I'll miss those really really short moments where like somebody hits the brakes and the rear wheel comes up on the bike, which is really always a very fun shot to take. And just to show you just how these guys are working the bikes into the corners. But you know, in general, I've just learned to just shoot conservatively, mm-hmm. efficiently on the. And I've never really run out of. I usually carry 8 gigs, and I've never run out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I think that should do it. Unless you have anything else that you wanted to add.
Be conscious all the time of, you know, you're at the track taking pictures, motorsports pictures of cars or bikes, but you should also be trying to take as good a picture as you can and thinking about light and composition and background and everything else you would be thinking of if you're taking a picture in any other situation. So while it's nice to get a nice sharp shot of a bike on the track, if it has an ugly background, or if the bike is doing something uninteresting, and you know, like we were talking about before, it just looks like it's parked there, or if the light is behind it or at an unflattering angle, you're not going to have a picture that pleases you. So in addition to all the technical things of the camera settings, you also want to think about what the picture is going to look like when it's done. Those same things I was talking about, composition, background, and things like that.
Excellent. We'll have to do this again because I want to also talk about, we started talking about, before we actually were recording this show, we were talking about aesthetics and you know, but I figured we'd concentrate just on the technical stuff this time around. So thank you very much for your time, Scott, and hope to have you on the show soon, and keep shooting away, dude.
I'm glad to do it. Same to you, and I will. I'll put a post up on my blog of the links to the posts that I've made when I've come back from a track day of shooting. You know, Bob goes track days where he rides. I have track days where I go shoot pictures, and each day I've come back, I've put up some my observations, things that I learned that day. So people who are going through the same thing might find those interesting to read, and I'll also link to some of the some of my favorite motorsports photographers who are pros who are doing really outstanding work that I admire a lot. So maybe you can add that to the.
I will website. Add a post to the to your blog, and people go find the your entry.
Okay, sounds good.
Fantastic.
Thank you very much, Scott. I'm sure we'll have Scott on the show in the future. He's actually, as I mentioned, you know, contributed material to the show before. I'm sure he'll do it in the future. And maybe we'll even do a little follow-up on this photography business stuff. There's some stuff we did not get a chance to cover yet, like focusing strategies and more about aesthetics versus just pure technique. So hopefully we'll have a chance to do that in the future. That pretty much does it for the show. This weekend, of course, is China. If you're in the U.S., make sure that you're aware of the time zone differences. The race in California, for example, is going to be shown at midnight on Saturday. So... Well, so that's Sunday morning, I guess. And just check your times and make sure you don't miss it. It's going to be a great race, I'm sure. So that's the show for today. Thank you for listening. Thank you for downloading. And be safe out there. Take care and ciao.